God's people said, amen. God is our refuge and strength. And aren't we thankful that He's a very present help in times of trouble? Where'd Vinon go? Is he still here? He left? I don't blame him after putting me on the spot. You're going to say, thank you, brother. Because after reading that first chapter of Ecclesiastes, I have a whole lot of explaining to do. In the recent archaeological excavations of my closet, I found a lot of neat things. Sandy, you're proud of me, aren't you, for cleaning up, for Joyce and I cleaning up my office and my closet. I found an old sermon, and it was so old it was handwritten. That was back, Tommy, before you and I had computers at First Baptist Church. You remember those days? And I know David Whiteman, they hadn't invented computers when you were here at First Baptist Church. Everything was either typewritten or handwritten. There's Vinon. I'm glad you came back in. I've got to explain this to you. But I found this old sermon, and I immediately recognized the title. The sun comes up, the sun goes down, and the world goes round and round. And the reason I recognize the title is I have a friend who remembered this sermon, even though it was almost 27, 28 years ago when I preached it, because from time to time he has reminded me that regardless of what happens in life, the sun comes up, the sun goes down, and the world goes round and round. But when I looked at this sermon, and when I read this sermon, Sterling, I hate to disappoint you, brother, but it wasn't very good. I said, what in the world was I thinking when I preached that? So with the exception of the title, which I think is a good title, this is a redo. If you listen to Venon when he was reading out of Ecclesiastes, the question comes up, all of the work that we do, all of the good things, all of the projects, all of the programs, what good does it do? What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Everything is vanity. Vanity of vanities, the preacher said. I've seen a lot in my day. The crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. Regardless of what we try to do, we can't change anything because the sun comes up, the sun goes down, and the world goes round and round. It reminded me of my first church where I worked as a youth minister, and I think I've shared this with you. I worked with a man, dear Brother Bill, bless his heart. Brother Bill had been around, I think he had served over 20 churches in his career. You think the committee may have noticed that, that there was a trend? But I remember the first meeting I had with Brother Bill. I was the new youth minister. It was way back when. I was so excited about being there. And I kept telling Brother Bill, now, when I get here, this is what I want to do. I'm going to get all these young people together, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And Brother Bill would look at me and said, oh, that won't do any good. We tried that in Demopolis years ago. People won't buy into that. And one thing I said was, we're going to have a 50s party. Now, this was the 70s. We're all going to dress up. We're going to, like, the 50s, and we're going to have a good time. He said, don't do that. Parents don't like their kids getting their hair greasy. And everything I brought up, Brother Bill said, it won't do any good. We've tried that before. There's nothing new under the sun. You ever feel that way? Regardless of how hard you work, regardless of how committed you are to a cause, regardless of how convinced you are it's the right thing, you wonder, is it worth it? Is it doing any good? And I will be the first one to confess that there have been many, many times that I have been totally convinced that I was doing something that was worthwhile, that I was doing something that would make a difference, or I have pushed for a certain program, or I felt like the decision that we need to make, I felt like I knew what the right decision was. And then I look back and I say, what was I thinking? That didn't turn out very well. What good did it do? The sun comes up, the sun goes down, and the world goes round and round. Don't let me lull you into sleep. So let me do some explaining about this first chapter of Ecclesiastes. In my old duct tape Bible, the old Oxford annotated, the first line of the explanation of Ecclesiastes is simply this: Ecclesiastes contains the reflection of a philosopher rather than a testimony of belief. This is a philosophical essay. This is a look at life. And one thing that has helped me to understand the book of Ecclesiastes is to look at the context in which it was written. Because there is another book of wisdom immediately before Ecclesiastes. I know our children are learning the books of the Bible, and that's a wonderful thing, because now, without looking for extra credit, does anybody know which book is before Ecclesiastes? Now, you get a star in your crown if you'll speak up. Proverbs. That's right. The book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs is a book of wisdom, and there is a prevailing view in the book of Proverbs, and if we turn to the second chapter of Proverbs, it goes like this. It says, so if you walk in the way of good men, if you keep to the paths of righteousness, the upright will inherit the land. Men of integrity will remain in it. But the wicked will be cut off. The wicked will be cut off from the land. The treacherous will be rooted out of it. The prevailing view of wisdom is essentially this. If you do the right thing, if you are a person of faith and a person of righteousness, if you do justice and love kindness and walk humbly with your God, you will be blessed. Good things will happen to you. You will be healthy. You will have good-looking children who are well-behaved and are successful in life. Everything will be good, but if you're not faithful, if you're unrighteous, if you don't walk in the paths of righteousness, then you'll have to pay the price. Now, all of that sounds good. In other words, good things will happen to good people when you do the right thing. Bad things will happen to bad people, except we all know that doesn't add up, does it? How do we explain when some of the very best people, the people who are the most faithful, the people who are the most righteous, the people who are always out there doing the work of God, when they get cancer? How do we explain something like yesterday, when good, godly people in their house of worship are gunned down? Is there any explanation? Is there any rhyme or reason? I have spent my whole ministry trying to answer this question, and there is no answer. This past week, I had one of God's greatest saints who looked at me and asked me the question, why does life have to be this way? I don't know. You know what Dr. Hope Kuhn used to say? He used to say that when he got to heaven and when he met God, he said, God has a whole lot of explaining to do. We don't have any answers. But one reason the book of Ecclesiastes was written was in response to this. The reason the book of Job was written was in response to this. Because you know about Job, a good man, a righteous man, a godly man, and all of these terrible tragedies happened to him. He lost his family, everything terrible happened. And his good friends came and said, well, Job, man, you really messed up, brother. What kind of sin have you done to deserve this? Job said, I haven't done anything. I've done all the right things. And the whole book of Job is dealing with this issue. And what the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying, sometime in life there's no rhyme or reason. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. The sun comes up. The sun goes down, and the world goes round and round. And sometimes there is nothing that we have done, or there is nothing that we can do to change that. But I think there's more to this. And one of the reasons we should never simply take one passage of Scripture or one book out of the Bible and develop a theology or a doctrine is because of Ecclesiastes. You wouldn't want your whole faith to be based on the first chapter, would you? Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And so let's look at the second passage that Venon read for us, that parable of the rich fool. This man who had all of the stuff, he had so much stuff that one day he said, what am I going to do with all my stuff? He had plenty of money and he said, I know what I'll do. I'll tear down all of my barns and I will build bigger ones to hold all of my stuff. And what does God say? He calls him a word we're taught not to use. He said, you are a fool You think you own your life? Tonight you will die. But the reason, Venon, that was such a long reading was because that story was set up by two brothers who were having a fuss over the family inheritance. Now, this only happened in ancient times, understand. Nothing like that would ever happen today. And they came to Jesus and said, "Listen, he thinks he has it this and that, and you decide." And Jesus said, man, who made me a judge over you?" But then he made this statement. He said, "A man's life does not consist of what? Of the abundance of his possessions." The key is abundance of his possessions. Last week, we looked at the story of another rich man, the rich man in Lazarus. He had it made in the shade, didn't he? He could eat anything he wanted to do. Well, he could eat cheese quesadillas and Chick-fil-A and pickles and anything he wanted anytime he wanted it. But what happened to this man? He didn't find meaning to life in what he ate. He didn't find meaning to life in what he had. I want to share something with you. Jesus never said, he talked about two rich men. He never said they cheated anybody, did he? He never said they gained their possessions by unscrupulous methods, did he? These were hard-working businessmen who knew how to make money. Is there anything wrong with that? Absolutely not. The question is not how many possessions do we have. The question is what do we do with the abundance? You remember when the rich man was in Hades and he lifted up his eyes and he saw Lazarus and he asked God, or he asked Abraham, he said, "Abraham, if Lazarus can't come and help me, then send him to my five brothers. I've got five brothers who need some help." The rich man was wrong. He didn't have five brothers. He had six brothers. One was named Lazarus, but he never recognized him. The meaning of life is not found in possessions or the food that we eat or the entertainment that we enjoy or all of the things that we value so much. The meaning of life is found in relationships and making a difference in the life of someone else. Now, we're celebrating the 501st anniversary of the Reformation. Martin Luther was a man who made a difference, I believe. Martin Luther was a man who changed the world. You cannot study Western civilization without studying Martin Luther. But let me tell you, there are not many Martin Luthers. Not many of us are going to change the world, are we? That rich man couldn't change the world, but he could change the world for Lazarus. You and I are not going to change the world, but there's somebody out there that we can make a difference in their life. You remember the story about the storm at the coast one night? And the next morning, all of these starfish had washed up on the shore. And you know, if a starfish is on the beach, it doesn't have any way of getting back in the water. And if it can't get back in the water, it's going to die. So here's a little boy who's walking along. He's picking up one starfish and then another and throwing it back in the water. And a man comes up and said, "Son, what are you doing?" He said, "I'm saving these starfish." He said, "Son, look at this. There are hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of starfish. You can't make a difference by just throwing a few in. And the little boy had one in his hand, and he said, "But I can make a difference for this one." You can make a difference for one person. The rich man could have made a difference in the life of Lazarus. Share another story with you. I told you about going to that church, my old brother Bill, that it's not going to work. Well, when I got to that church way back in, 44 years ago, I had an old car, even old back then. It was a 62 Chevrolet Bel Air, my favorite car I've ever owned. It had the gear shift on the steering wheel column. That car had a whole lot of issues. I used to pull into a gas station and say, "Would you fill it up with oil and check the gas?" I had to put 2 or 3 quarts of oil in every 50 miles or so. First time I pulled into that church parking lot, Dr. Graham, good old stately Dr. Graham, dignified Dr. Graham, was standing there. Here's his new youth minister coming in. I started pumping the brakes. Did I tell you the brakes didn't work sometimes? And you had to pump the brakes, and I didn't pump them enough, and I ran into the wall. Got out of the car. I said, "I'm your new youth minister." We had a wonderful time in that old car back in 1974. You know how many young people you can put in a 62 Chevrolet Bel Air? I think I lost count at about 25 one night. But we had a grand time. The last day I was there that summer, I loaded my old car up, pulled into the parking lot, and all those kids were there. We were trying to say goodbye. You know how you say goodbye in the South? You stand there for 30 minutes, 45 minutes. Well, I got to go now. I got to go now. Finally, one boy said, "Hold on just a second." He ran into the kitchen of the church and came back with the butcher knife. I said, "This is not good." And he got down underneath the back end of the car. And a minute later, he said, "Go, go, get out of here." A few weeks later, they invited me to come back. They had a picnic. They had a cookout. All of those kids were telling me what a difference that summer had meant to them. Brother Bill came up to me and said, "I told you if you listened to me, it'd turn out well, just like this." And Joey, the boy who cut something off the back of the car, this is the end of the tailpipe that had rusted off, and it was hanging by a strap. Had been that way for a long time. And he cut that off, and he painted it gold. And they presented it to me that night, and said I was a member of the Order of the Golden Tailpipe for distinguished service. A few years ago, on Easter Sunday, a stranger came into our sanctuary, a young lady. And she came up and said, "Do you remember me?" I didn't have a clue who she was. She had been one of those young people who had been there one day. And she was taking her son to Wake Forest, where he was enrolling as a freshman. And she said, "My whole life, I've been telling him about what a good time we had and what a difference you made in our life. And I keep this as a reminder that even though the sun comes up and the sun goes down and the world goes round and round, we can make a difference. We can make a difference if we make a difference through Christ." We're going to sing a hymn together. We're going to sing a hymn of faith. Guide me, O thou great Jehovah. And as we do, we open the doors of the church and we invite you to respond, but more than responding publicly, to respond knowing that we can truly make a difference in the life of someone else.